Lisa, I know that Janet is for a couple of weeks joining us on Wednesday instead. Still missing a few people, no?
Yes, you are.
Who else is, who are you missing?
Adina.
Okay, Adina, I'm sure will come.
Jan Adelman.
Jan Adelman, another.
Ruthie.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to jump in for now.
Okay.
Okay. One second, I need to do one thing first before I share screen. And there's Adina.
Linda, we're missing Linda.
Oh, and there's Jan. Okay, we're getting there. So we've got Adina, you are mute. If you want to say something, you need to unmute. I'll unmute for you. Yeah, there you go. You okay?
Okay, I unmuted.
Okay, good.
But I couldn't get it on my iPad. That's okay, because I didn't store the link properly.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to need help storing your link. I could get it on my phone, but not there. Okay.
Right.
Thanks.
The other thing you can do, and I'll show you how to do that, is maybe I'll send it to you maybe by, hang on a second.
Just remember, I'm in the lower class of, in the lowest class.
No, that's not what I meant.
All right. I'm getting better, but I don't love it.
All right. Let's,
okay,
let's start.
I found it, but for me it was hard.
Okay, so we were sort of at the tail end of our discussion related to Perek Dalid, which is the story of Rechavin Ba'ana coming into the house of Ishbosheth and killing Ishbosheth and cutting off his head, running his head to David HaMelech, saying, "Here, look what I've got for you," and David saying, "How dare you," and taking Rechavin Ba'ana and executing them and hanging them in public in order to demonstrate what happens when if you try to kill Ishbosheth. That story of Perek Dalet, and we ran all the way to the end of the Sefer to Perek Chav Aleph in an attempt to try to understand some of the background to the story, and we ended up spending a couple of weeks reviewing or learning Perek Chav Aleph, which is the story of Shaul's treatment or mistreatment of the Givonim. And how the Givonim enter into this picture is a part of the mystery. So to remind everybody, we started with the fact that these two individuals who killed Ishbosheth, Rechav and Ba'ana, are described as Bnei Rimon HaBe'eroti. Rimon could be their father's name. It's also the name of a Canaanite god or Canaanite deity, Melech Aram, the god of Aram. And they come from the city of Be'erot. Be'erot are one of the four cities of the Givonim from the days of Yehoshua. And on top of that, it says, Vayivrechu ha-Be'erotim. The Be'erotim had run or escaped to Gittaim. Vayusham garim ad hayom hazeh. That information is irrelevant to the story of our Perek Dalet, that the Be'erotim had fled to Gittaim, which is an Eretz Plishtim, and there they lived. And so one of the suggestions that we offered was that, in fact, the Be'erot is one of the cities of the Givonim, had escaped to Eretz Plishtim at the time that Shaul had, what is described in Perek Chav Aleph, that Shaul had killed all the Givonim, or had expelled all the Givonim, in direct violation of the oath that Yeshua and the Zakenim had taken to the Givonim back in the days of Yeshua. And so that story is inserted here to tell us that maybe Rechavim Ba'ana are not of Binyamin, Sheva Binyamin, but rather Be'erot Techashev al Binyamin. The Be'erot is considered part of Binyamin territorially, even though it's really a city of the four cities of the Givonim. So all the evidence here points to the fact that Rechavim Ba'ana are not from Sheva Binyamin, but are in fact Givonim. And the motivation behind their attempt or their execution of Ishbosheth is motivated by a kind of vengeance against Ishbosheth ben Shaul for Shaul's treatment of the Givonim years back. That led us to the story of the Givonim, Parakhav Aleph, in which it says that there was a famine for 3 years. And David sought God's counsel what this famine was about. And God said to him, El Sha'ur ve'al Beit Adamim al Asher Himit et ha-Givonim. That the famine was retribution for two things, Sha'ur and the fact that Sha'ur had killed the Givonim. And Chazal split that phrase into two different issues, namely Sha'ur, Sha'ur nispad kalacha, who wasn't properly buried in his hometown, and the state funeral, he wasn't given proper cover, and that's on David. And at the same time, holding Shaul accountable for having mistreated the Givonim. So we spend a good deal of time talking about the story of the Givonim and why Shaul kind of pours his wrath out against them to expel them. Various suggestions made. The last one that we ended up with was the possibility that the Givonim had kind of played neutral in the famous war of Michmas against the Plishtim. Shaul's first major battle against the Plishtim allowed them access through their land, and as retribution for that, Shaul decided to annul the pact, annul the vow that Yehoshua had made, and expel the Givonim. The Radak very clearly says that this was a terrible Chilul Hashem because it indicated that he was not properly following he was not giving proper due to an oath taken in God's name.
Rabbi,
yeah.
What did Shaul have against the Givonim? What did they do?
That's the question, and it's a little bit of a mystery. So Mefarshim have different possibilities or offer different possibilities. Some suggest it has to do with the city of Nov. That he poured, when he killed Nov, he kind of blamed the Givonim. They were part of the temple operation. That would put it in a much later story. Others suggest that it was just part of his cleansing of the land of Israel from the Canaanite influence, and he decided to change policy. We had suggested that it went back to the story of the Battle of Michmas, which was a battle Shaul fought against the Plishtim very early on in Shmuel Aleph. And in that battle, the Plishtim were on the east side of the mountain ridge that is protected by the Givonim. And so it would seem evident that they allowed the Plishtim through, and that was a political miscalculation.
How did the Givonim become part of doing all of this? I mean, who invited them from the beginning? How did they become part of it?
How did they become part of what? Israel?
No, how did they become part of the temple? How did they become the people
That's part of Yehoshua. That in the aftermath of the oath that they made in the days of Yehoshua, the brit that they made, Yeshua allows them to stay in the land, and he gives them a job, he gives them a role. He makes them what the Sefer Yehoshua is called Chotve Etzim V'Shoavei Mayim. Right, so they kind of have that role in general.
Okay.
All right. So in the meantime, the story gets very dark because at some point David is forced to go to the Givonim and say to them, how can I appease you? And they say, we don't want any financial appeasement. We don't want land or territory. What we want is vengeance from the descendants of Shaul. Yutan lanu shiv'a anashim mibanav boka'anum Hashem b'givat Shaul b'chir Hashem. You give us seven of Shaul's descendants, and we will hang them in Givat Shaul, or in the Givat that belongs to Shaul. This Bechir Hashem, the chosen of God, is either a cynical comment, or as the Mefarshim suggests, it's kind of the Navi interjecting that Shaul is the Bechir Hashem, and here they're publicly mistreating them by trying to kill the descendants. Come back to that. And David is forced to do so. However, he has compassion on the son of Yonatan, Mephibosheth ben Yonatan, because of the oath that he took to Yonatan. And so he gives the Givonim seven of the descendants, but not the direct descendants, let's call them, not the children of Yonatan, but rather two of the children of Ritzpah bat Aya, who was Shaul's Pilegesh, and five children of, this is not Michal, this is really Merav, we talked about that before as well, Merav bat Shaul Asher Yalda Azriel ben Barzilai HaMacholati. And they are killed, they're hanged publicly in order to demonstrate this retribution against Shaul. And they stay there for several months from the harvest until the beginning of the rain season. And it falls on Ritzpah bat Aya, the Pilegesh, Patikach Ritzpah bat Aya. She sits there for all those months to protect the bodies of these seven descendants of Shaul from any harm from the from being consumed by the birds or the beasts of the field. And when David hears what she did, he realizes that that's a sign to him that he needs to give proper cover to the bodies of those of Shaul's family that have died. And so he goes and he takes the bones of Shaul, who's buried out near Machanaim in the outside of, on the other side of the Jordan River near in the city of Yavesh Gilad, takes his bones and Yonatan together with the bodies of the seven people who were hanged by the Givonim, and he brings them to he gathers all the bones together, and he brings them to what we call Nachalat Avot, inheritance of the family, brings them to bury in Kever Avot.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Was there no pushback that this was going to be the kind of punishment? Because, like, how do you then choose who the seven people are that you're giving to be killed? Like, at the end of the day, you're still taking somebody's life as a result of it.
Correct.
And there doesn't seem like there was any discussion, sort of, like, even go back to the story with Lot, with Abraham and Hashem, with Lot. Like there was a bargaining that happened. And here it's like, we want seven people as retribution. It's like, okay, here, take seven people. Like,
correct. So part of that is
that.
Right. So part of that is an understanding that this whole story starts with the recognition, but with David's turning to God and asking him through the Urim Batumim what should be done, and God's answer is, "You go to the Givonim. This needs to be addressed." So part of that, and that's how the Mefarshim struggle with it, is the understanding that this was an instruction. This was God's way of saying to him, you need to appease the Givonim. And so whatever the Givonim tell you, that is, it would seem, going to be the mechanism by which it's going to happen. The question that needs to be asked, and that's the question that the Mefarshim ask, is what do these children do? Why appease the Givonim by punishing what seems to be seven innocent children or grandchildren? What did they do wrong in this context? Why are they the ones held accountable for the sins of their father or grandfather? And that's the moral question in this parak, which I want to address today, because I need that piece of information is critical for us to be able to move forward into the return to parak Dalet in terms of what's going on there. So that's sort of where we ended up with exactly this issue. What's the issue with the seven grandchildren? Why are they, or children and grandchildren? It's two children of the Pilegesh and five children of Michal or Merav, which is two children, five grandchildren. What did they do in this story? Why are they held accountable? And so let's see if I can do this way. Can you see the source page now on the screen?
Yes.
Okay. So this is the source page that I actually, same source page we had last couple of weeks. I'm putting it on the screen for anybody who is joining us today. If you send me a note, I will email it to you. But this essentially is the question asked by the Radak. The Radak formulates it most directly, although all the Mefarshim really struggle with the same question. And he says the following. V'im tamar, v'imah ne'enash zar'o, why should Shaul's children be punished in a manner for Shaul's chet? This is Shaul's issue. So he offers a question. Maybe, and this is something which some of the Mefarshim suggest, kind of imply, you'd have to assume some level of guilt on behalf of these seven people, otherwise there would be no point. So maybe they were the ones who went and executed, who perpetrated this crime against the Givonim, you know, kind of the princes of the officers in the king's army. Maybe. However, the Radak is not as comfortable with that, and he says, "Yitachen ki lo ayu ela hashivam me'ahargim sharei ketanim ayu." If you go back to the fact that this story, even though this famine is taking place later, but the actual events of Shaul killing the Givonim is, or expelling the Givonim, is a very early story. It goes all the way back to the beginning of Shaul's reign, which means that the grandchildren of Shaul would have been, if they were even born, they would have been young. And if they would have been young, then, especially in the case of Merav is not even married yet. If the story is, if we go back to the Battle of Michmas, Merav, that's before David comes on the scene, Merav is not even married. So clearly that's not going to be a sufficient answer. So he offers a second possibility. The principle that a person cannot be held accountable for the sins of their father, and that you cannot punish the child for the sins of the parents, that's true in the operation of an earthly court. A court cannot punish a child for the sins of a parent or vice versa. But when it comes to how the heavenly court operates, says the Radak, there it's a different principle. There it says, "Paked avon avot abanim ve'abnei banim ve'al shilishim ve'aribayim," that a parent can be, that the sins of a parent can be held accountable and paid back on the children and grandchildren and great grandchildren for three generations. Now that's true. It is such a pasuk, but the Radak is clearly aware of the caveat that Chazal understood in that statement. That's provided that the children continue the ways of their father. So that's true. There is such a principle of visiting the iniquity of the parent, of a generation on the children and grandchildren for generations, for four generations. Even though this instruction, this killing of these seven children, was executed by man, meaning the Givonim. Shaul and David hands them over. Nonetheless, b'mitzvat hakel haita, it was by divine decree, because after all, it was God who so instructed. Varehi kimita b'deshamayim, so it has the status of sort of the rules of the heavenly tribunal rather than the rules of the earthly tribunal. That is the suggestion of the Radak. I don't know about you, I'm still left a little cold by this suggestion on several fronts, including the assumption that somehow the children are, in order for this to operate, you have to assume that the children are in some way guilty, and yet we have no evidence to that fact. We'll come back to that. And number two, this notion that somehow the heavenly court operates with more vengeance, if you will, than the earthly court also bothers me a little bit. Normally we perceive it the other way around. So I'm still uncomfortable with this, with what we have termed the moral question of what do these seven children have to do with any part of the story. So where are we at? What do we do with this? I want to come back to the question of where this is all taking place. So if you remember, let's see how quickly I can get to that map. Sorry, I had meant to pull this all up before we started so that I wouldn't have to do this, but we're going to do it anyway. Just pulling up the map of the cities of the Gibbonim. Okay, so there's Beirut. Actually, let's pull up the whole, all the way to, okay, here you have more or less a map of the area. Here's Be'erot, which is the story that we're discussing. Be'erot al Binyamin Techashev, Geva, Giv'on, the cities of the major cities of the Givonim are Kiryat Yarim, Giv'on, Be'erot, and Kfirim, and Kfir. Here's Yerushalayim, Nov, down here on the eastern ridge. This is Yerushalayim. We know where Telstone, Kiryat Yerim is today. These are the cities of the Givonim, all in Shevet Binyamin. So I'll come back to the story in a moment of the Givonim, but I want to come back to Rechavan Ba'ana. Let's come back to Perek Dalet for a second. Rechavan Ba'ana, B'nei Rimon, Habbe'eroti, Mibnei Binyamin. And we talked about the fact that this notion of this emphasis on Be'erot, which is one of the cities of the Givonim, is mentioned several times in this parak. Why is it so relevant that it's mentioned several times in this parak? Why does it have to tell us that Be'erot is, which was originally a Givon city, is now a city of Binyamin? I'll come back to a different question. I'm going to kind of use that as a jumping point to a different issue, which is after Shaul removes the Givonim from these cities, Be'erot, Givon, Kiryat Yarim, sort of major centers in Shevet, in the area of Shevet Binyamin, particularly Givon, I want to focus on for a second. After Shaul removes the Givonim from this area of the country, who settles therein? Who moves in and settles in their land? We don't know. It doesn't tell us explicitly. However, the city of Givon has caught my attention. What? Do you remember the first battle between David's forces and Ishbosheth's forces? Back in Perek Bet. Remember that was the battle where they had a standoff and they marched 21 people into the middle of the field and they had a war of champions of 21 people from each side. Remember that battle back in Perek Bet? Gimel. I think it's in Perek bad. Vayhi mispar yamim asher vayetze Avner ben Ner v'yavdei Ishboshet ben Shaul mimachanayim Givona. Avner ben Ner and his servants or his officers, who was the general of Ishboshet ben Shaul, took his forces from Machanayim, which is on the east side of the Yarden, and came to Givon. V'yoav ben Tzruya v'avdei David yatzu v'yifkeshu b'brichat Givon yachdav. That first skirmish back in Perek Bet that started the war, that has been going on now for several years, started in what city? It started in the city of Givon. Why Givon? Why of all places? Avner comes from his forces all the way from the east side of the yard and comes down to Givon. Yoav takes his forces up from Yerushalayim, from Shevet Yehudah, into Shevet Binyamin, into the heart of Givon, into Givon. Why in Givon? So we offered several reasons for why Givon became the centerpiece of the battle between David and Ishbosheth's forces. One was that Givon was the place where the Mizbeach was. The Mizbeach has been in Givon since the fall of Nob. And so it had a kind of a symbolic meaning. But the other, remember what the other reason we offered for why Givon was? Divrei Yamim Aleph Perek Tet, listing the family of Shaul. Psukim Lamed Hey through Mem. Uba Givon Yashvu Avi Givon Yiel Vishem Ishto Macha and his firstborn Avdon, Sur, Kish, Baal, Ner, and Nadav. Gedor and Achyoz, Chayag, Miklot, a couple of other descendants. Pasuk Lametet, V'ner holidet Kish, V'kish holidet Shaul, V'shaul holidet Yonatan bet Makishu bet Avinadav bet Esh Baal, V'ven Yonatan midi Baal, midi Baal holidet Micha, etc. Why is all of this of any relevance? What does all this tell me? Where is the ancestral, where is the family of Kish and the family of Shaul living, and where is Shaul born? In the city of?
Givon.
In the city of Givon. In the city of Givon, which means that Givon is not just one of the four cities of the Givonim, but that Givon, in fact, might have been, was the home birthplace of Shaul, and therefore from Shaul's family held a particularly important place. Now, if that's true, then let's go one step further. After Shaul removes all of the Givonim in violation of the oath with that Yoshua and his kingdom had taken to the Givonim, and he clears out the Givonim from four cities, Be'erot, Givon, Kiryat Yearim, and Kfir, who's settling in those four cities? B'nei Binyamin, I assume. It's in the territorial region of Binyamin. Including, if the king takes land, conquers land, and takes land, then there is a certain assumption that land now belongs to the king, his officers, his kingdom, and maybe even his family. And so you have to ask the question, which is not stated in Tanakh, which is, where are Shaul's children living? Where, in what cities are they settling? And if the ancestral land of Kish and his family is Givon, would not be a stretch to assume that to Giv'on returns the family of Shaul. Actually, an interesting observation. If we come back to Perek of Aleph, I actually want to see if I can pull up the Malbim. And this pasuk, which is the pasuk that describes what the Givonim do to the children of Shaul, it says, "Give us seven of the children of Shaul, v'ka'anum la'Hashem b'givat Shaul, and we will hang them publicly in Givat Shaul." Why in Givat Shaul? So the Malbim suggests, "V'noka'atam b'givat Shaul, we will hang them in Givat Shaul, shesham b'nei Binyamin." Because that's where the children of Binyamin are living. Umishpachat Shaul and the family of Shaul, Hanim Shachim Od Achar Da'ato, who are following in his footsteps. V'yiru, let them see, let them be afraid, let them sit there a bit, let them understand the consequences of what they've done. I want to make one observation, one small twist. The Givat Shaul can mean Givat Shaul, which is where Shaul had set up his capital, but Givat Shaul could mean something else completely. Is it Givat Shaul refers to Giv'on? We have a whole new story. Because now we have Shaul, for whatever political reasons, political agenda he has, takes the Giv'onim and expels them from the land in violation of an oath that he took to the Giv'onim that they had made to the Giv'onim generations back. And who settles in the very cities that they then expel the Giv'onim from? Shaul's children and grandchildren, his descendants. I want to remind you of a story that appears in Sefer Malachim. We haven't gotten to it yet, which is why I'm reminding you of it. But this is a story of Ahav. A very powerful story. At the end of Ahav's life, Ahav comes to his palace and he sees that there's a vineyard nearby and he likes this vineyard and he wants to take it from an individual by the name of Navot HaYisraeli. Navot doesn't want to sell. Ahav is all upset. He comes back to his house and he says, "Oh, he's kind of depressed. He wants this vineyard, and this Navot the Israeli won't sell it to him." So he comes back and Izevel, his wife, who we have described many times as the wicked witch of the East or wicked witch of Tanakh, Izevel, his wife, comes to him and he says, "What are you? Why are you so sad?" And Ahav says, I wanted to buy this land, but Navot refused to sell it to me. So she, who's a Canaanite, says to him, "What kind of a king are you? You want a piece of land and they won't give it to you, so you come home depressed? That's what a king does? A king who wants a piece of land, he takes it. Get up, you eat bread. I'll get you this kerem by the end of the day." So she sends a letter, and she has it signed and sealed, and this letter accuses this guy, Navot HaYisraeli, who is a very nice Jew living nearby, sends him a letter sends the army a letter saying that this, she hires two baseless people to go and bear witness against him. Hoshivu shnayim anashim b'nei b'liyal negdo v'ya'idu le'mor b'rachta Elohim b'melach, to accuse him of treason, of cursing God and cursing the king, and take him out and have him stoned. So this Izebel deals with the problem in a simple way, the way she was brought up in her household, daughter of the king of Sidon in the north. Somebody doesn't want to do what you want them to do. You're the king, you have them killed. So she has Navot HaYisraeli killed, and now, If you are killed for treason, your lands become confiscated by the king. Let me repeat that. If you are killed for treason, your lands become the property of the kingdom. So they do exactly what she says. And they proclaim, they take this Navot out, and they have him killed. Done. They send message back to Izebel. Navot is dead. the moment she hears that Nevot was taken out and stoned, Batomer Izevel el Achav, she comes back to Achav and says to him, Kum, get up. Resh et Kerem Nevot Israeli, go and inherit, go and take possession of the vineyard of Nevot Israeli. He refused to sell it to you, but Ein Nevot Chai Kimet, now he's dead. So it's not a problem. Now you can go and confiscate the land. When Achav heard that Nevot had died, he wasn't privy to all the details that, and the trap that Nevot, that Izebel had set. But Yaakov Achav levedet el kerem Nevot Israeli l'ishto. He went down to settle, to take possession of this kerem. God came to Eliyahu at that moment and he said to him, Kum red l'krat Achav melech Yisrael b'shamon, go down to Achav melech Yisrael and tell him the following. And you'll find him, I'll tell you where to find him. You'll find him inside, enjoying his siesta in the vineyard of Nevot Israeli. V'dibarta elav lemor. The three most famous, probably the three most famous words in all of Tanakh. This is what you're going to tell him. Sorry about that. Come on. Let's do this right. There we go. Haratzachta v'gam yarashta. My dear Eliyahu, you had him killed, and then you went and you enjoyed the territory, and then you took his land. Which is the bigger crime, having him killed or having or taking his land?
I would like to think having him killed is the bigger crime.
Having him killed is the bigger crime. And yet Eliyahu's instructions by God to Eliyahu to tell Achav is, what, you're going to commit murder and then take his land? So what does that mean?
Well, that's
the straw to break the camel's back. That's the decree on Achav that his household will be destroyed and his kingdom will come to an end. Why? Because essentially, first of all, he didn't do the murder. Izebel did. Second of all, and he didn't even know about it, he enabled it. He empowered it by empowering Izebel, but he didn't actually do it. But he's held accountable for it. But more importantly, why is the Yerusha, the inheritance, the taking of this land, considered so much more offensive a crime?
But he didn't even know how it happened.
Correct. He's still accountable. He's the king. And is this and it's the queen who did so. Why is this so offensive a crime? What does the phrase mean? Haratzachta v'gam yarashta. Are you gonna kill and then inherit the very land you killed for? It's like to add insult to injury. You committed a crime, you wanna on some level, you could say that there was you were mistaken, and maybe it was committed treason, maybe you didn't know, maybe he severed it, etc. Right? You can go and you can appease and you can do tshuva and you can figure out a way to kind of navigate out of it. But when you go and you take the land and you turn the crime of murder into murder for your own personal gain, you've transformed it from some context of punishing somebody who's accused of a crime into a clearly a perpetrated personal agenda. This phrase, "Ratzachta v'gam yarashta," becomes a kind of the moral stamp, the moral straw to break the camel's back on top of everything else. And it's this crime that Achav is held accountable for, not the idolatry for all of the generations of idolatry that he enabled, right? It's this moral crime, "Ratzachta v'gam yarashta," that ultimately brings Achav's kingdom down, crumbling down. That's the moral intensity of how dare you benefit personally from that which you've, a crime you've already committed.
So does this mean also that here, you, again, you can do children and grandchildren and they can be responsible for this and therefore you can kill them too?
In which case?
In this case right here, like what he did was so wrong and everything. Does that mean that the children and grandchildren for something like this can be, they can be accountable?
We'll come back to the children and the grandchildren in a second, but I'm talking about, here he's talking about punishing Achav. right? And here he's telling Achav, Achav, you are going to die for this, right? Because of the crime you committed. I want to, if you're talking about the story of Bnei Sha'ol, I will come back to the story of Bnei Sha'ol with a simple question. Where are Bnei Sha'ol living?
In Givon.
In the land.
In Givon.
In Givon.
In Givon. And if they're living in Givon, then this is one of those examples of Haratzachta v'gam Yirashta for the children. It's one thing to, again, Shaul's crime is on Shaul's head. But the household of Shaul is now benefiting personally from that crime of a Chilul Hashem on an order of magnitude, on a national scale, because they then went and settled in the very area of Giv'on that we are describing. And that may be, and again, we are deep into the world of conjecture here because we don't have all the information, but that may be why Bnei Sha'ul are held accountable for this crime. Ultimately, for they are the ones who benefited from it. Because they are the ones who are from in the household of the king, the palace of the king, living in the area of Giv'on. And therefore, when the Giv'onim kill or hang them, they hang them in Givat Sha'ul, which in this case is not Givat Sha'ul of Yerushalayim, but Givat Sha'ul of the Giv'onim, the household or the territory that belonged to, that Sha'ul had taken for his family. So that's the background to Perikov Aleph. And I, more or less, that kind of completes a study of Perikov Aleph. We now have to go back to Perik Dalet. All right. So let's come back to Perik Dalet. And let's come back to Perik Dalet. And ask ourselves the question, that famine that is described in the beginning of Perikov Aleph, when did this famine occur? This is the critical question I asked at the very beginning of our study of this parak. What was the time frame of this story? When did it occur? Now, there are several possibilities. Possibility number one, at this Perikov Aleph at the end of Sefer Shmuel Bet, Rabbi made David Shaloshanim. Clearly, it's the days of David because David is king. It says so. So maybe it occurred exactly where it is, in the end of Sefer Shmuel Bet, meaning at the end of David's life, the end of David's reign. And just read the chapters in sequence. That's possible. We ruled that out. Why did we rule that out? We ruled that out very early. What was the rationale for, why did we rule out the possibility that this was happening in late in the end of Sefer Shmuel Bet? Because the four prakim that appear at the end of Sefer Shmuel are clearly a postscript to the Sefer, the kind of earlier events that are happening at a different time. Why they are at the end of the Sefer, Shirat David, Divrei David Achonim, the list of all the Giborim, the battle with the Plishtim, which is clearly earlier, right? All of these stories, the search for the place for Har HaBayit, story of the threshing floor of Arabna Yibusi, right? All of these clearly earlier stories, they don't belong at the end of the Sefer. Why they're put at the end of the Sefer is a question we'll study at the end of Sefer Shmuel Bet, but they are clearly earlier events. So that leads us to a search. When is there a time of this famine for 3 years that would be an appropriate place to put this story? So I'll tell you what the classic or suggestion is, and then we're going to offer an alternative. Classic suggestion is to place this story more or less around the time of Perek Chet or Tet. And we have not learned those prakim, so this is a little bit of a kind of a guess. You just have to take my word for it. But the reason why they place the story more or less between Perekhet and Perektet of Shmuel Bet is because, actually I need to pull up, it's the wrong sefer, Shmuel Bet, Perektet, is because in Perektet, David is looking for descendants of the house of Shaul with whom to treat with kindness because of his oath to Yonatan. And he finds that there's a servant of the household by the name of Tziva, and he comes over to him and he says, are there any descendants to Shaul? And are there any descendants to Yonatan? And Tziva tells him, yes, there's a cripple by the name of Mephibosheth. And so David calls Mephibosheth, he meets Mephibosheth for the first time, he sits him down and he says to him, you will remain in my palace, I will feed you for the rest of your life. So there are those who suggest that our famine for 3 years and our story of David appeasing the Givonim is part of this story of Perektet. Why? What's the evidence to that effect? What evidence is there here that links this story to the story of Perachav Aleph?
Because he has to look for descendants of Shaul to pick for the Givonim.
Well, descendants of Givonim, of Shaul to the Givonim that he's dealt with, but here he's looking for descendants of Yonatan to whom to treat with kindness and chesed. And he meets for the first time Mephibosheth.
It isn't strange that there's only one descendant?
Yeah, because all the other three sons were killed in battle, and the only one left is Ishbosheth. Ishbosheth was killed, and so Yonatan has one son. His name is Mephibosheth.
Okay.
From Mephibosheth, the rest of the household, the descendants will be rebuilt. But in Perekhov Aleph, it said that David had compassion on Mephibosheth and spared him. Remember that? In Perekhov Aleph, it said that Vayachmol HaMelech al Mephibosheth ben Yonatan ben Shaul al Shvuat Hashem Hashem Yonatan. So that would seem to indicate that David knows Mephibosheth and spared him because of his oath. Yet he doesn't meet Mephibosheth until Perek Tet. You follow? So from that perspective, and that's sort of where I think classically the Mephoshim put the story of the famine of 3 years, more or less shortly after Perek Tet, his first meeting of Mephibosheth.
Yeah. I gotta mute this.
However, that's not conclusive, because it's possible that this pasuk in Perekhov Aleph simply means that David had compassion on Yonatan's children, whoever they are. We happen to know his name is Mephibosheth, but David may not have met Mephibosheth yet, even if he decided to spare Yonatan's children from this wrath. Remember, who does David take to hand to the Givonim? This is a very important piece. Who of Shaul's descendants does David take to hand to the Givonim? Two children of Ritzpah Bat Aya, the Pilagesh, and five children of Merav, meaning married to Adriel ben Barzillai Mocholati. What do those seven people have in common? Two sons of the Pilegesh and five sons of Merav married to Adriel ben Barzillai Mocholati.
They're not in line. They were not in line for the throne.
Correct. None of them are in line for the throne. None of them are competitors to the throne of David. The only one who's a competitor for the line of the throne is Yonatan, and it's Yonatan's descendants who David Dafka spares. And that's very important, because if it wasn't for that point, what could you accuse David of doing?
Wiping out the line. right? Wiping out
protecting
all
protecting his throne by eliminating throne. Any potential threat to that throne or claim to the throne of Sheol. But by handing over to the Givonim Dafka those who have no access or no claim to the throne, and preserving or having compassion or sparing those who have aligned to the throne, at least in David's mind, for those who saw or understood what was going on, right? David was trying to protect from the accusation that he was in some way trying to eliminate any threats to the throne, or to solidify his own position. So it doesn't have to name Mephibosheth by name. He's just the issue here is that he is sparing the children of Yonatan, who is Ben Shaul, because he's trying to preserve his oath to Yonatan and to Shaul, but also not to give off the impression that he is in some way trying to solidify his own kingdom by eradicating the claims to the throne. That piece.
But in some ways, that makes it harder for David to have done this.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
And there's even, in some ways, more of an ethical problem, because he's now taken completely innocent people.
Well, they're not innocent. Again, if we come back to the issue of Ratzachta v'gam Yerashta, but from the perspective of the throne, they're not a threat to his throne. Correct. We'll see how that plays out in a second, but they're not a threat to his throne. Again, this is Beitzav Hashem, whatever the morality of it is, but the only way I really understand it is if they're living in the city of the Givonim, then that's Ratzachta v'gam Yerashta, right? That's exactly why they can be held accountable. It's also true that in the world of kingdoms, in the world of Malchus, kings and their descendants are held accountable on a different level than the average person is. But that's a more complex piece. But at the end of the day, this doesn't need to happen in the context of Perek Tet when he first meets Mephibosheth, because the subject here in Perek of Aleph is really about the descendants of Yonatan, whatever their names are, right? If it's named, Mephibosheth is named, even if David hasn't yet met Mephibosheth. So I come back to this question. When does the story of this famine for 3 years take place? And the clue, I think, lies, and this is how we started this discussion. The clue, I think, lies in the phrase Chazal used to describe the chet that is being appeased, if you will, where God says to Shaul, to David, El Shaul ve'el beit damim al asher emit et ha-givonim. Shaul and the bloody house for having killed the Givonim. So Shaul's household is being held accountable for the crime against the Givonim. They're going to have to pay. Haratzachta v'gam yirashta. But what does El Shaul mean? And here, Chazal saw in this parak two different issues. They saw the Givonim is one parasha, and they saw a different parasha, namely the fact that Shaul's body is sitting out in Yabesh Gilad, in the outskirts of the land of Israel, not being given proper respect and accorded proper state burial. So the language of Chazal is, Al Shaul Shaul Nispad Kahalacha, V'abet Adamim Asher Emitu the Givonim. We are holding you, this famine is caused by two things. Number one, Shaul's crime, and number two, Shaul's lack of cover given to Shaul's burial. And we asked the question when we first started learning this parak that seems to be two very contradictory themes. Right? On the one hand, is Shaul the perpetrator of the crime here, or is Shaul the victim of the crime? Is the crime here that he wasn't given proper covet, or is the crime that he perpetrated a crime against the Givonim? Why is there a famine? For two reasons: because you treated Shaul unjustly, and because Shaul acted unjustly. You can't have both. And you can't hold and both emerge from the story of the Perek, because on the one hand, you appease the Givonim, and on the other hand, the end of the Perek, after the story of Ritzpah Bataiah, David goes and he brings Shaul's body and Yonatan's body and this body of these seven children, and he brings them to proper burial in the family burial ancestral land of Kish. And at the end of the story, it says, Vayater Elokim la'aretz achrechein, and only after that did God bring rain upon the land. So I have two very contradictory themes going on here. And it's possible that they can both live side by side, but I was going to suggest to you that maybe, and this comes back to our parak, that maybe the issue here is that we're not holding the same person or the same group accountable for two contradictory crimes. But rather, you're dealing with a split kingdom. And the kingdom of David, Malchut Yehuda, is held accountable for the lack of kavod that David demonstrated by allowing Shaul's remains to live buried on the other side of the Jordan in Yavesh Gilad. That's Shaloni Spad Galacha. Who is accountable for the crime of the Givonim? Not Yehuda, but Binyamin. And that this phrase that Chazal used to describe two contradictory crimes are because we're really dealing with two different groups. There's only one period of time in David's reign that the kingdom is split. Right? Once we get past Perek Hay, the kingdom is no longer split. Right? It's unified. Back when they come after the death of Ishbosheth, they come running to David, and David becomes king over all of Israel. There's only one window in which David is king, but there's a split kingdom. And that's between Perek Aleph and Perek Dalet. And if that's the window, a window in which Shaul is still out in Yavesh Gilad, David is in Yehuda, and Binyamin is held accountable for the story of the Givonim, then that puts us into a very small window of Perek Bet, Gimel, or Dalet. It has to be before the murder of Ishbosheth, because after the murder of Ishbosheth, they come running to Yerushalayim and to Yehuda, to David in Hebron to unify the kingdom. You follow what I'm suggesting? I'm trying to narrow the window of this 3-year famine. And David is only in Hebron for 7 years. So there isn't a lot of time for this story to take place. But if in fact this story is the backdrop to the story of Perek Dalet, now it sends a whole new message, or infuses a whole new message into the story of Perek Dalet. So imagine for a moment that sometime between Perek Bet and Gimel, remember there's a war in Givon, the territorial control of Givon, right? And all of this appeasement of the Givonim is happening during this period of time. And Yoav and Abner are fighting for control of Givon while David is out appeasing the Givonim. It's a kind of an interesting contrast. But imagine for a moment that this story is happening as the backdrop between Perek Gimel and Perek Dalet. David, the end of this famine of 3 years, David has to go and appease the Givonim because of the crime of Shaul and Malchut Binyamin. And David has to deal with the burial of Shaul. Let's take that assumption. To the outside world, what does it look like? To the outside world, what does the world see in David's behavior? You may see David as acting on God's command to right the wrong of Haratzachta v'gam Yerashta, maybe. Do you remember how Shimri Megera described it? This we talked about a couple of weeks ago. when Shimon, when David in the rebellion of Absalom, David runs, and he's escaping from Yerushalayim, and he meets this man from Sheva ben Yamin, by the name of Shimon ben Gera, and Shimon ben Gera publicly curses David, and he says, Heshiv alecha Hashem kol demei beit Shaul asher malachta tachtav. God has returned upon you the house of the blood of the house of Saul in whose stead you reign. What is Shimon ben Gera accusing David of? Accusing David of having killed Shaul and the royal killed the royal house of Shaul? All the blood of the house of Shaul, in whose stead you reign. The events of David handing over Shaul's descendants to the Givonim is from the outside world is a stain on David's record. How many people know that David did so by the instructions of the Urim V'Tumim and therefore had no choice? Well, how many people perceive that David was discerning enough to make sure that he took only people who weren't a claim on this throne so that it could be understood that he wasn't trying to eradicate the royal family to strengthen his hold on the kingdom? That's a subtlety we understand. How many people in the Amcha could pick that up? Right? Shimon Megara certainly didn't. Now let's reread the story. Ishma Shaul ben Kimet Avner b'Chevron. Ishbosheth hears that Avner dies in Chevron. He gets very weak. He's very afraid. He doesn't know what's going to happen. Ushne anashim sarei gdudim ayu ben Shaul. There were two officers in the army of Ishbosheth ben Shaul. One was called Baana, the other was Rechav. Sons of Rimon, habbe'eroti, they are, according to this interpretation, giv'onim, serving in the army. Mibnei Binyamin, from the territorial area of Binyamin. Ki be'erot t'chashev Binyamin, because be'erot, even though it's a giv'onite city, was considered part of Sheva Binyamin at this point in time. Vayivrechu habbe'erotim gitayma, the be'erotim had run, fled to Gitaim in Eretz Plishtim, vayisham garim ad hayom hazeh. Leave out the story of Mephibosheth. These two Givonim, Bnei Rimon and Be'eroti, come to, by the name of Rechav and Ba'ana, come to the house of Ishbosheth in the middle of the day. And he's sleeping the rest of the siesta. They come into the house, he's lying on his bed. They smote him, they cut off his head, they take his head, and they go all the way down south, running to David and Chevron. They come to David in Chevron, with the head of Ishbosheth, and these two Givonim say to David in Chevron, v'yemlu al ha-melech, Hinei Rosh Ishbosheth ben Shaul Oyivcha. Here is the head of Ishbosheth, son of Shaul, your enemy. Hashem bikeshet nafshech. Iten Hashem ladani melech nekamot ayom hazeh mishaul umizar'o. May God give you vengeance against Shaul and against all of the seed of Shaul. Before we get to David's answer, what's driving Rechav and Baana? So again, if they're just two Binyaminites who come and they think that David would benefit from the death of Ishbosheth, so be it. But if they're Givonim, so two things. Number one, their motivation for killing Ishbosheth is vengeance, right? Shaul had become the enemy of the Givonim. If they are Givonim, then their motivation to kill Ishbosheth is vengeance. Moreover, the motivation to cut off the head of Ishbosheth and to bring the head to David in Hebron is driven by what? What do they expect?
Aren't they expecting that David will be pleased with them and maybe give them something or another? Some reward?
Even more. What do they essentially say to David? Assuming that the story of Perech of Aleph and the execution of the seven descendants of Shaul is the backdrop to this Perech, then what have they just said to David? David, you are on a campaign, clearly, to eradicate the house of Shaul. You've killed seven. Here's another one for your trophy. It's a whole different picture. David, you killed seven of the descendants of Shaul. You missed one. We took care of him for you. Ishbosheth. Here's his head. It's further confirmation that driving this, the motivation is not just the personal vengeance, but they see themselves as acting as part of this whole campaign of what was done against the Givonim. We are now exacting retribution for the crimes against the Givonim. David killed seven of the descendants of Shaul. Very nice. Here's the eighth. Here's Ishbosheth. We did it. We took care of him for you. And David's reaction is extreme, because David has to put a stop to the impression that what's driving this is personal vengeance and motivation and political vengeance. So David's response to Rechavan Bana, he says to them, listen, that guy, that Amalekite who came and told me that about Shaul and who took part in the death of Shaul, I had him hanged. You wicked people who killed an innocent man sleeping in his bed. I will hold you accountable. And look what he does to them. He cuts off their hands and their feet and he hangs them. That is a very cruel type of public display of punishment. Why does he do it? Now I have an explanation as to why he does it. Cuts off the hands and feet and hangs them publicly. Why? You're all on mute, so you're gonna have to unmute yourself if you want to speak. What do the Givonim do to the descendants of Shaul? You're all on mute. You're going to have to unmute yourselves, guys.
They hang them.
In a very cruel way. Hang them and hang them publicly and hang them and left them hanging. So what does David do to these two Givonim, who come to him with the impression that, hey, David, we're going to finish the job for you. You started this campaign to eradicate the house of Shaul. We're going to process it for you. What does he do? So he takes the two Givonim and he says, I'm going to do to you what the Givonim did to the descendants of Shaul. He says, let it never be said that I acted out of personal vengeance to eradicate or to destroy the house of Shaul. So, and then he gave this head of Ishbosheth a burial in the very capital of David's kingdom in Hebron. So again, the story can be understood on multiple levels, but assuming that it is connected to the story of Perech of Aleph, that backdrop gives us a new insight into what's driving both Rechavan Ba'anah's motivation and David's reaction. Because what's at play is the perception that David, or trying to address the perception that David on some level is trying to eradicate the house of Shaul, and that's why he plays into the hands of the Givonim, and David needs to put a stop to that. David needs to make it very clear that he was acting on God's instructions, and that he dafka took people who were guilty of the inheritance of the land of the Givonim, but ones who were not acclaimed to the throne, And the moment Rechavim Ba'ana crossed the line to assume that he was trying to eradicate the descendants of the house of Shaul, he reacts harshly to them in order to protect that integrity of the house of Shaul. And at the same time, he goes and he brings the bones of Shaul and Yonatan and the seven people, and he buries them in a proper burial of Hespin and public state funeral, etc., all in order to demonstrate that from David's perspective, he always treated Shaul as Bechir Hashem, the anointed, the choice one of God, and not as a perpetrator of the crime. I go back to that pasuk in Perichav Aleph, in which the moment they decide to bury, to hang the seven children, the pasuk says that they hang them in Givat Shaul. That the Mefarshim say this expression Bechir Hashem to describe Shaul as the choice of God, as the chosen one of God. That's the Ruach HaKodesh, that's the Navi speaking and saying that they may have seen Shaul as the enemy, but we have to always remember that Shaul was in fact the choice and the chosen of God. All right, that brings us to our close of study of Perek Dalet combined with Perek Chaf Aleph. Zrat Hashem, next week we will move on to Perek Hey and start a whole new chapter. I'm going to unmute you all. All right, that's what we're going to conclude today. I appreciate and thank you for joining us, including those who have joined us from Israel. special treat to have the Israelis with us in this call.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank
Our
you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, Jackie.
Bye.